not forsake me, oh my darling. On this our wedding day, do not forsake me, oh my darling. Wait, wait long. I do not know what fate awaits me. I only know I must be brave, and I must face a man who hates me, or lie a coward, a craven coward, or lie a coward in my grave.
What time is it when they want to take your guns away? What time is it when they tell your children not to pray? What time is it when the silent unborn scream? What time is it when the teeming masses teem? What time is it when there is no cry of treason? What time is it when there is no sense of freedom? What time is it when there is great deceit? What time is it when there is no retreat? What time is it when wickedness abounds, when all the bodies are found? What time is it when it's the color of law? What time is it when we don't see what we saw? What time is it when the cattle cars come, and when they beat the war drums? What time is it when faith is abhorred? What time is it when they're mocking the Lord? What time is it when the money's no good? What time is it when they poison the food? What time is it when the killing begins? And when the spin doctor spins? What time is it when the truth is suppressed? And when a nation's distressed? What time is it when they use razor wire? What time is it when it's ready, aim, fire? What time is it when we owe global tax? And when our bombers attack? What time is it when our rights are being taken? And our heritage is doomed or forsaken? What time do you think? The time is high noon. It's showdown time when they confiscate arms. It's showdown time when they do your children harm. It's showdown time for the blood of the aborted. It's showdown time to stop them at the borders, to execute the traitors. It's showdown time to take back education. It's showdown time to declare the truth bold. It's showdown time, my friends. There's no place to go. It's showdown time for the forces of evil. It's showdown time and the charges are leveled. It's showdown time for the great Constitution. And showdown time for all men of conscience. It's showdown time because, well, it can't happen here. If you have ears to hear, and if you know your Bible, for the end time revival, it's showdown time for the moneylenders, showdown time for government blunders, it's showdown time when they burn us with fire, it's showdown time for media liars, it's showdown time to defeat trickery and to proclaim liberty. It's showdown time. We will not be cattle, for we're ready for battle. It's showdown time to destroy the UN. It's showdown time. Bring our troops home again. It's showdown time. Lawful order to restore. It's showdown time. Remember evermore. It's showdown time for America very soon. It's showdown time. It's high noon.
Oh, my darling. On this our wedding day, do not forsake me, oh my darling. Wait, wait long. I do not know what fate awaits me. I only know I must be brave, and I must face a man who hates me, or lie a coward, a craven coward, or lie a coward in my grave.
It's high noon. Frank Miller and the boys are coming to meet us very soon. Will we, like Marshall Kane, be prepared to meet that destiny? It's a difficult one. Bennett, I'm asked, how are we going to combat the technologically advanced weaponry of a government, chiefly one that is going to be supported and backed up by the United Nations if we are to allow that kind of a mentality to continue? A friend of mine recently forwarded me a question that a friend of his had posed. If and when our federal government comes to pilfer, pillage, plunder our property and destroy our lives, what good can a handgun do against an army with advanced weaponry, tanks, missiles, planes, or whatever else they might have at their disposal to achieve their nefarious goals? I'm not being facetious, my friends. I accept the possibility that what happened in Germany or similar could happen here. I'm just not sure that the potential good from an armed citizenry in such a situation outweighs the day-to-day problems caused by masses of idiots who own guns. And yet, if I may, I'd like to try to answer the question. What good can a handgun do against an army? I certainly don't think the writer facetious for asking the question. The subject is a serious one that we've given much research and considerable thought to. And I believe that upon the answer to this question depends the future of our constitutional republic, our liberty, and perhaps our lives. Aaron Zellman, one of the founders of Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, once stated, "If every Jewish and anti-Nazi family in Germany had owned a Mauser rifle and 20 rounds of ammunition and the will to use it, Adolf Hitler would be a little-known footnote to the history of the Weimar Republic." Note well that phrase, my friends, and the will to use it. For the simply stated question, what good can a handgun do against an army, is in fact a complex one and must be answered at length and carefully. It is a military question. It is also a political question. But above all, it is a moral question, which strikes to the heart of what makes men free and what makes them slaves. Let us first attempt to answer the military question. Most military questions, by the way, have both a strategic and a tactical component. Let us consider the tactical. A friend of mine owns an instructive piece of history. It is a small, crude pistol made out of sheet metal stampings by the United States during World War II. And while it fits in the palm of your hand and is a slowly operated single-shot arm, its powerful 45 caliber projectile will kill a man with brutal efficiency. And with a short, smooth barrel, it can reliably kill only at point-blank ranges. So it Its use requires the will, brave or foolhardy, to get in close before firing. It is less a soldier's weapon than an assassin's tool. The United States manufactured them by the millions during the war, not for our own forces, but rather to be airdropped behind German lines to resistance units in occupied Europe. Crude, slow. The fired case, by the way, had to be knocked out of the breech by means of a little wooden dowel, a fresh round procured from the storage area in the grip, and then it had to be manually reloaded and cocked. And so wildly inaccurate, it couldn't hit the broadside of a French barn at 50 meters. To the resistance man or woman who had no firearm at all, it still looked pretty damn good. You see, the theory and the practice of it was this. First, you approach a German sentry with your little pistol hidden in your coat pocket and, with Academy Award sincerity, ask him for a light for your cigarette, or the time the train leaves for Paris, or if he wants to buy some non-army-issue food, or maybe even a half hour with your sister. And when he smiles and casts a nervous glance down the street to see where his sergeant is at, you blow his brains out with your first and only shot, then take his rifle and ammunition. Your next few minutes are occupied with getting out of Dodge, for such critters generally go around in packs. And after that, assuming you evade your late benefactor's friends, you keep the rifle and hand your little pistol to a fellow resistance fighter so they can go get their own rifle. Or maybe you then use your rifle to get a submachine gun from the sergeant when he comes running, or perhaps you get very lucky and pick up a light machine gun, two boxes of ammo, and a haversack of hand grenades. With two of the grenades and the expenditure of a half box of ammo at a hasty roadblock the next night, you and your friends get a truck full of arms and ammunition. Of course, some of the cargo is sticky with Boche blood, but you don't mind that oh so terribly, do you? Pretty soon you got the best armed little Maquis unit in your part of France. All from that cheap little pistol and the guts to use it. Of course, one wonders if the current political elite's opposition to so-called Saturday night specials maybe just doesn't come from some adopted racial memory of previous failed tyrants. Even cheap little pistols are a threat to oppressive regimes. By the way, they called the pistol the Liberator. Not a bad name, all in all. Now let's consider the strategic aspect of the question. What good can a handgun do against an army? We have seen that even a poor pistol can make a great deal of difference to the military career and post-war plans of one enemy soldier. That is tactical. But consider what 1 million pistols, or 100 million pistols, which may in fact approach the actual number of handguns in the United States today. What can all those numbers mean to the military planner who seeks to carry out operations against a populace so armed? Mention Afghanistan or Chechnya some years ago to a member of the Russian military hierarchy and watch them shudder at the bloody memories. Then you begin to get the idea that modern munitions, air superiority, and overwhelming precision-guided violence still are not enough to make victory certain when the targets are not sitting Christmas present fashion out in the middle of the desert. I forget the name of the senator who observed once, you know, 1 million here and 1 million there, and pretty soon you're talking about serious money. It might have been Tip O'Neill. But, you know, consider that there are at least as many firearms, handguns, rifles, shotguns, as there are citizens in these United States of America. Consider that last year there were more than 14 million Americans who bought licenses to hunt deer in this country. 14 million! That's a number greater than the largest 5 professional armies in the world combined. Consider also that those deer hunters are not only armed, but they own items of military utility. Everything from camouflage clothing to infrared game finders, global positioning system devices, and even night vision scopes. Consider also that quite a few of these hunters are military veterans. Just as moving around in the woods and stalking game are second nature, military operations are no mystery to them, especially those who were on the receiving end of guerrilla war in Southeast Asia. Indeed, such men, aging though we may be, maybe more psychologically prepared for the difficulties of civil war, for this is what we are talking about, my friends. We may be more psychologically prepared than our younger active duty brother soldiers whose only military experience involves neatly defined enemies and fronts in the grand campaign against Saddam, and now whatever it is we're doing against Osama for whatever purposes. Not since the 1861 to 1865 period in this country has the American military attempted to wage a war athwart its own logistical tail, nor indeed has it ever had to use modern conventional munitions in the main streets of its own hometowns and through its relatives' backyards, nor has it tested the obedience of soldiers who took a very different oath with orders to kill their rebellious neighbors. But that touches on the political aspect of the question. Oh, and let's not forget homeland security now. But for a moment, let us forget the psychological and political and consider just the numbers. To paraphrase the senator, a million pistols here, a million rifles there. Pretty soon you're talking about serious firepower. No one, repeat, no one will conquer America from within or without until its citizenry are disarmed. We remain, as a British officer had reason to complain at the beginning of our revolution, a people numerous and armed. The Second Amendment is a political issue today only because of the military reality that underlies it. Politicians who fear the people seek to disarm them. People who fear their government's intentions refuse to be disarmed. And our founders understood this. And so, too, does every tyrant who ever lived. Liberty-loving Americans forget it at their peril. And until they do, American gun owners in the aggregate represent a strategic military fact and an impediment to foreign tyranny. They also represent the greatest political challenge to homegrown would-be tyrants. If the people cannot be forcibly disarmed against their will, and they must be persuaded to give up their arms voluntarily. This, my friends, is the siren song of gun control, which is to say government control of all guns. Although few self-respecting gun grabbers would be quite so bold as to phrase it so honestly. Joseph Stalin, when informed after World War II that the Pope disapproved of Russian troops occupying Trieste, turned to his advisors and asked, The Pope, how many divisions does he have? You see, dictators are unmoved by moral suasion. Fortunately, our founders saw the wisdom of backing the First Amendment up with the Second. The divisions of the Army of American Constitutional Liberty get into their cars and drive to work in this country every day to jobs that are hardly military in nature. Most of them are unmindful of the service they provide. Their arms depots may be found in innumerable closets, gun racks, gun safes. They have no appointed officers, and nor will they need any until they are mobilized by events. Such guardians of our liberty perform this service merely by existing. Are you one of those guardians? And although we may be an ever-diminishing minority within this nation as gun ownership is demonized and discouraged by the ruling elites, still, we are as yet more than enough to perform our vital task. And if we are unaware of the impediment they present to our would-be rulers are painfully aware of these divisions of liberty as evidenced by their incessant calls for individual disarmament. They, the tyrants, understand moral versus military force just as clearly as Stalin. But they would not be so indelicate as to quote him. The Roman Republic failed because they could not successfully answer the question, who shall guard the guards? The founders of this republic answered that question with both the First and Second Amendments. And like Stalin, the Clintonistas never cared what common folk said about them, no differently than the Bushistas do. the concept of the armed citizenry as guarantors of their own liberties sets their teeth on edge and disturbs their status sleep. Governments, some great men once avowed, derive their legitimacy from the consent of the governed. In the country that these men founded, it should not be required to remind anyone that the people do not obtain their natural God-given liberties by the consent of the government. And yet in these past 100 years or so, our once great constitutional republic has been so profaned in the pursuit of power and social engineering by corrupt leaders as to be unrecognizable to the founders. And in large measure, we have ourselves to blame because at each crucial step along the way, the usurpers of our liberties have obtained the consent of a majority of the governed, or shall we call them ruled, to do what they have done. Often in the name of democracy, a political system rejected, by the way, by our founders. Another friend of mine once gave the best description of pure democracy I've ever heard. He said, democracy is three wolves and a sheep sitting down to vote on what to have for dinner. The rights of the sheep in this system, my friends, are by no means guaranteed. And now it is true that our present wolf-like would-be rulers do not as yet seek to eat that sheep and its peaceably woolly cousins, we the people. They are, however, most desirous that the sheep be shorn of taxes, and if possible and when necessary, be reminded of their rightful place in society as good citizen sheep, whose safety from the big bad wolves outside their barn doors is only guaranteed by the omnipresence in the barn of the good wolves of the government. Indeed, they do not present themselves as wolves at all, but rather these lupines parade around in sheep's clothing, bleating insistently in falsetto about the welfare of the flock and the necessity to surrender liberty and property for the children, the lambs, in order to ensure future generations of compliant sheep. They are careful to educate the lambs in a way of political correctness, tutoring them in the totalitarian face that it takes a barnyard to raise a lamb. And all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. Well, every now and then, some tough old independent-minded ram refuses to be shorn and tries to remind the flock that they once decided affairs themselves according to the rule of law of their ancestors and without the help of their so-called betters. And when that happens, the fangs become apparent and the conspicuously unwilling or shunned, cowed, driven off, or occasionally even killed. But flashing teeth or not, the majority of the flock has learned over time not to resist the lupine mandarin class which herds it. Their founders, who were fiercely independent rams, would have long ago chased off such usurpers. Any present members of the flock who think like that are denounced as anti-Devillian, or mentally deranged, or right-wing conspirators. Oh, there are some of these dissidents the lupines would like to punish, but they dare not, for their teeth are every bit as long as their betters. Indeed, this is the reason the wolves haven't eaten any sheep in generations. To the wolves' chagrin, this portion of the flock is armed, and they outnumber the wolves by a considerable margin. Oh, that we do. But for now, the wolves are content to watch the numbers of these armed sheep diminish, as long teeth are no longer fashionable in polite society. Indeed, they are considered by the literati to be an anachronism best forgotten. And such sheep are dismissed by the mandarins as tooth nuts or, right leg fanatics. When the numbers of armed sheep fall below a level that the wolves can feel safe to do so, the eating will begin. Oh, but the wolves, my friends, are patient and have been for a long time. They proceed by infinitesimal degrees, like the slowly boiling frog. It took them generations to lull the sleep into accepting them as rulers instead of elected representatives. If it takes another generation or two of sheep to complete the process, the wolves can wait. This is our animal farm. Without apology, to George Orwell. Even so, my friends, the truth is that one man with a pistol can defeat an army. Given a righteous cause to fight for, enough determination to risk death for that cause, and enough brains, luck, and friends to win the struggle. This is true in war, but also in politics. It's not necessary to be a Prussian militarist to see it, the dirty little secret of today's ruling elite as represented by the current regime is that they want people of conscience and principle to be divided in as many ways as possible, wedge issues, the consultants call them, so that we may be more easily manipulated. No issue of race, religion, class, or economics is left unexploited, lost in the din of jostling special interests of the few voices who point out that if we refuse to be divided from what truly unites us as a people, we cannot be defeated on the large issues of principle, faith, the Constitutional Republic, and the rule of law. And more importantly, woe and ridicule will be heaped upon anyone who points out that, like the blustering Wizard of Oz, the federal tax and regulation machine is not as omnipotent, or fearsome as they would have us believe. Like the wizard, they fan the scary flames higher and shout, "Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain." My friends, I like to have considered myself the man behind the curtain for nearly 7 years now. Do pay attention to me. But the truth is, you see, they, the big boys, the government, the wolves, are frightened that we will find out how pitifully few they are compared to the mass of the citizenry that seeks to frighten into, that they seek to frighten into compliance with their tax collections, property seizures, and bureaucratic unconstitutional power shifting. I strongly recommend everyone see a film that's probably 4 or 5 years old now. It's called A Bug's Life. You see, simple truths may often be found sheltering beneath unlikely overhangs. They're protected from the pelting storm of lies that soak us every day. The Bug's Life, a children's movie of all things, is just such a place. And it's interesting, as of this recording, the Disney Channel just recently began to air A Bug's Life on their own little network. Let me share with you. The plot revolves around an anthill on an unarmed island, where the ants placate predatory grasshoppers by offering them each year one half of the food they gather. Kind of sounds like the Magnificent Seven, doesn't it? Or the IRS. Well, driven to desperation by the insatiable tax demands of the large, fearsome grasshoppers, one enterprising ant goes abroad seeking bug mercenaries who will return with him and defend the anthill when the grasshoppers return. Grasshoppers who roar about like some biker gang, or perhaps the ATF and black helicopters, take your pick, are at one point in the movie lounging around a bug cantina down in Mexico, living off the bounty of the land. The harvest seeds they eat are dispensed one at a time from an upturned bar bottle. Two grasshoppers suggest to the leader, a menacing fellow named Hopper, whose voice characterization by Kevin Spacey, an anti-gunner, by the way, is suitably evil personified. Well, they then forget about the poor ants on the island. Here they say, "We can live off the fat of the land. Why worry about some upstart ants?" Well, Hopper turns upon them instantly. "Would you like a seed?" he quietly asks one. "Well, sure," answers the skeptical grasshopper thug. "Would you like one?" Hopper asks the other. "Yeah," says he. Hopper manipulates the spigot on the bar bottle twice and distributes the seeds to them. "So you want to know why we have to go back to the island, do you?" Hopper asks menacingly as the thugs munch on their seeds. "I'll show you why," he shouts. Removing the cap from the bottle entirely with one quick blow, the seeds, no longer restrained by the cap, respond to gravity and rush out all at once, inundating the two grasshoppers and crushing them. Hopper turns to the remaining fellow grasshoppers and shrieks, "That's why." I'm paraphrasing, of course, this from memory, but I've only seen the movie parts of it once. But Hopper then explains, "Don't you remember the upstart ant on that island? They outnumber us 100-1. How long do you think we'll last if they ever figure that out?" "If the ants are not afraid of us," Hopper tells them, "our game is finished. We are finished." Of course, it comes as no surprise that in the end, the ants do figure it out. Would that liberty-loving Americans were as smart as animated ants? Oh, how I wish it were so. Courage to stand against tyranny, my friends, fortunately, is not only found on videotape. Courage flowers from the heart, from the twin roots of deeply held principle and faith in God. There are American heroes living today who have not yet performed the deeds of principled courage that future history books will record. They have not yet had to stand in the gap to plug it with their own fragile bodies and lives against the evil that portends. Not yet have they been required to pledge their lives, their fortunes, their sacred honor, and yet they will have to. You see, I believe with all my heart the lesson that history teaches, that each and every generation of Americans is given, along with the liberty and opportunity that is their heritage, the duty to defend America against the tyrannies of their day. Our fathers, fathers, fathers fought this same fight. Our mothers, mothers, mothers fought it as well. From the Revolution through the World Wars, from the Cold Wars through the Gulf, they fought to secure their liberty in conflicts great and small, within and without. They stood faithful to the oath our founders gave us to bear true faith and allegiance, not to a man, not to the land, not to a political party, but to an idea. That idea, liberty, as codified in the Constitution of the United States. We swear, as did they, an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And throughout the years, they paid in blood and treasure the terrible price, that oath. That was their day. This is ours. The clouds, my friends, that we can see on the horizon may be a simple rain or a vast hurricane, but there is a storm coming. Make no mistake about it. Lincoln said that this nation cannot long exist half slave and half free. I say, if I may humbly paraphrase, that this nation cannot long exist one-third slave, one-third uncommitted, and one-third free. The slavery today is of the mind and the soul, not the body, but is slavery without a doubt that the administration and their toadies are pushing. It is slavery to worship our nominally elected representatives as our rulers instead of requiring their trustworthiness as our servants. It is slavery of the mind and soul that demands that God-given rights that our forefathers secured with their blood and sacrifice be traded for false security of a nanny state, which will tend to our legitimate needs as they are perceived by that government. It is slavery of a more traditional kind that takes half of our wages as taxes to feed the infernal boilers of that same government. And like the slaves of old, we pay our oppressors for the privilege of serving them. It is slavery to worship humanism as religion and slavery to deny life and liberty to unborn Americans. As people of faith in God, whatever our denomination, we are in bondage to a plantation system that steals our money, seizes our property, denies our ancient liberties, denies even our very history, supplanting it with sanitized and politicized correctness, denies our children a real public education, denies them even the mention of God in school, denies, in fact, the very existence of God himself. And so finally we are faced with, we must return to the moral component of the question, what good can a handgun do against an army? The answer is nothing, or everything. The outcome depends upon the mind and heart and soul of the man or woman who holds it. One may also ask, what good can a sling in the hands of a boy do against a marauding giant? If your cause is just and righteous, then much can be done. Not only if you are willing to risk the consequences of failure and to bear the burdens of eternal vigilance. Someone I met recently gave me a plaque, and upon it was written the words of Winston Churchill, a man who knew much about fighting tyranny, even though he was part of the system. Churchill stated, still, if you will not fight for the right when you can easily win without bloodshed, if you will not fight when your victory will be sure, and not too costly, You may come to the moment when you will have to fight with all the odds against you and only a precarious chance of survival. There may be a worse case. You may have to fight when there is no hope of victory because it is better to perish than to live as slaves. The Spartans of old knew this. The fighting Jews of Masada knew this, when every man, woman, and child died rather than submit to Roman tyranny. The Texans who died at the Alamo knew this. The frozen patriots of Valley Forge knew it. The expendable men of Bataan and Corregidor knew it. If there is one lesson of Hitlerism in the Holocaust, it is that free men, if they wish to remain free, must resist would-be tyrants at the first opportunity and at every opportunity. Remember that whether they come as conquerors or elected officials, the men who secretly wish to be your murderers must first convince you that you must accept them as your masters. Free men and women must not wait until they are selected, divided, and herded into Warsaw ghettos, there to finally fight desperately, almost without weapons, and die outnumbered. The tyrant must be met at the door when he appears. At your door or mine, wherever he shows his bloody appetite. He must be met by the pistol, which can defeat an army. He must be met at every door, for in truth we outnumber him and his henchmen. It matters not whether they call themselves communists, or Nazis, or fascists, or Republicans, or Democrats, or something else. It matters not what flag they fly, nor what uniform they wear. It matters not what excuses they give for stealing your liberty, your property, your life. By their works, ye shall know them. My friends, the glare of the fire at Waco. Few of us realize at the time that the Constitution was burning right along with the Davidians. The time is late. Those who once had trouble reading the hour on their watches have no trouble now. We have had the advantage of that horrible illumination for more than 7, 8 years now, 10 years almost. All these years which the rule of law and the battered old parchment of our beloved Constitution had been smashed, shredded, besmirched. In this process, they have been aided and abetted by the cowardly incompetence of a so-called opposition leadership, a fact made crystal clear by Waco hearings. All of these people forgot Daniel Webster's warning where he stated, "Miracles do not cluster. Hold on to the Constitution of the United States of America and the Republic for which it stands. What has happened once in 6,000 years may never happen again. Hold on to your Constitution, for if the American Constitution shall fail, there will be anarchy throughout the world." And yet, my friends, being able to see what has happened has not helped us reverse or even slow the process. The sad fact is that we may have to resign ourselves to the prospect of having to maintain our principles and our liberty in the face of becoming a disenfranchised minority within our own country. The middle third of the populace, it seems, will continue to waffle in favor of the enemies of the Constitution until their comfort level with the economy is endangered. That may be sooner than they think. They've got theirs, Jack, the Republic rats who we thought could represent our interests and protect the Constitution and the rule of law have been demonstrated to be political eunuchs. Alan Keyes was dead right some time ago when he characterized the elections as one between the lawless demagogues and the gutless Republic rats. The spectacular political failures of our leaders are unrivaled in our history unless you recall the unprincipled jockeying for position and tragic comedy of misunderstanding and miscommunication which led to our first civil war. Make no mistake about it, my friends. It is civil war, which may be the most horrible corollary of the law of unintended consequences as it applies to the Clintonistas, the Bushites, all of their destructions of the rule of law, because such people have no cause for which they are willing to die. They cannot fathom the motives of behavior of people who believe that there are some principles worth fighting and dying for. And out of such failures of understanding come wars. Particularly because although such elitists would not risk their own necks in a fight, they have no compunction about ordering others in their pay to fight for them. It's not the deaths of others, but their own deaths which they fear. And as a Christian, I cannot fear my own death. But rather I am commanded by my God to live in such a way as to make my death a homecoming. That this makes me incomprehensible and threatening to those who wish to be my masters is something I can do little about. I would suggest to them that they not poke their godless, tyrannical noses down my alley. Oh, no siree. As the coiled rattlesnake flag of the revolution bluntly stated, "Don't tread on me." Or as the state motto in Alabama says, "We dare defend our rights." But can a handgun defeat an army? Yes, my friends. It remains to be seen whether the struggle of our generation against the tyrants of our day in the first decade of the 21st century will bring a restoration of liberty and the rule of law, or a dark and bloody descent into chaos and slavery. If it is to be the former, I will meet you at the New York town. If it is to be the latter, I will meet you at Masada. But I will not be a slave. And I know that whether we succeed or fail, if we should fall along the way, our graves will one day be visited by other free Americans, thanking us that we did not forget that with the help of Almighty God, in the hands of a free man, a handgun can defeat a tyrant's army. Without apology, I am Jeffrey Bennett.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
It's happening, ladies and gentlemen. We here at RBN are working with Front Sight Firearms Training Institute to bring our audience the best in combat, tactical, and defensive firearms training. Whether you're a private citizen who is new to firearms, or you have a concealed weapon permit, and want a level of training that surpasses what you've received from your local gun range, Front Sight provides priceless education and skills taught by seasoned law enforcement, military, and private citizen instructors to levels that far exceed law enforcement and military standard. With nearly a million responsible citizens trained from every town, city, and state from across the United States, Front Sight has bolstered the Patriot movement to a whole new level. Contact Dan Sutterfield by phone at 573-762-2356 or 573-465-2356, or shoot him an email at domedan, D-O-M-E-D-A-N, at hotmail.com. This is a limited time opportunity. Don't miss it.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Have you been looking for a trusted long-term storable food company? We have a solution for you. Simply Clean Foods is dedicated to providing the best quality food you can buy next to fresh from a farmer's market. Our line of resealable fruits, vegetables, and meats are suitable for everyday use, and you won't have to worry about throwing away valuable groceries ever again. Our food is completely GMO-free, and our stringent quality controls, plus testing for heavy metals, makes us unique in the storable foods market. Simply Clean Foods' primary focus is to bring clean food to people all around the world and change the way we look at freeze-dried food in our daily cooking. When you purchase from simplycleanfoods.net, not only will you be receiving high-quality food, but you will also be supporting veterans in need across the country and those who are affected by natural disasters. Right now, Amazon Prime members will receive fast 2-day shipping. Go to simplycleanfoods.net. That's simplycleanfoods.net. But do it today.
As long as I breathe, I'd rather die on my feet than live on my knees.
In all practical purposes, it is a miserable scenario. Written by Raymond K. Padden, or Payden, P-A-D-E-N. I came across this piece 4 or 5 years ago. It's entitled Sundown at Coffin Rock. The old man walks slowly through the dry, fallen leaves of autumn, his practiced eye automatically choosing the bare and stony places in the trail for his feet. There was scarcely a sound as he passed, though his left knee was stiff with scar tissue. He grunted occasionally as the tight sinews pulled. Damn chainsaw, he thought. Behind him, the boy shuffled along, trying to imitate his grandfather, but unable to mimic the silent motion that the old man had learned during countless winter days upon this wooded mountain in pursuit of game. He's 15 years old, the old man thought. Plenty old enough to be learning. But that was another time, another America. His mind drifted. He saw himself, a 15-year-old boy, following in the footsteps of his own grandfather. Clutching a 12-gauge in his trembling hands as they tracked a wounded whitetail. Now, the leg was hurting worse now, and he slowed his pace a bit. Plenty of time. Should have been my own son here with me now, the old man thought sadly. But Jason, he had no interest, no understanding. He cared for nothing but pounding on the keys of that damn computer terminal. He knew nothing about the woods or where food came from or freedom. And I guess that's my fault, isn't it? And the old man stopped, held up his hand, motioning for the boy to look. In the small clearing ahead, the deer stood motionless, watching them. It was a scraggly buck, underfed, sickly, but the boy's eyes lit up with excitement. It had been many years since they had seen even a single whitetail here in the mountain. After the hunting had stopped, the population had exploded. The deer had eaten the mountain almost bare until erosion had become a serious problem in some places. That following winter, 3 starving does had wandered into the old man's yard, trying to eat the bark off his pecan trees. And he had wished the animal rights fanatics could have been there then. It was against the law, but old man knew a higher law, and he took an axe into the yard and killed the starving beasts. They did not have the strength to run. The buck finally turned and loped away, and they continued down the trail to the river. And when they came to the big oak, the old man turned and pushed through the heavy brush beside the trail, and the boy followed wordlessly. The old man knew that Thomas was curious about their leaving the trail, but the boy had learned to move silently, well, almost. And that meant no talking. And when they came to Coffin Rock, the old man sat down upon it and motioned for the boy to join him. "You see this rock shaped like a casket?" the old man asked. "Yes, sir." The old man smiled. The boy was respectful and polite. He loved the outdoors, too. Everything a man could ask in a grandson or a son. "I want you to remember this place and what I'm about to tell you. A lot of it isn't going to make any sense to you, but it's important, and one day you'll understand it well enough." The old man paused. And now that he was here, he didn't really know where to start. "Before you were born," he began at last, "this country was different. I've told you about hunting, about how everybody who obeyed the law could own guns. A man could speak out anywhere without worrying about whether he'd get back home or not. School was different, too. a man could send his kids to a church school or a private school or even teach them at home, but even in the public schools, they didn't spend all their time trying to brainwash you like they do at yours now. The old man paused and was silent for many minutes. The boy was still, watching a chipmunk scavenging beside a fallen tree below them. Things don't ever happen all at once, boy. They just sort of sneak up on you. Oh, sure, we knew guns were important. We just didn't think it would ever happen in America. But we had to do something about crime, they said. It was a crisis. Everything was a crisis. It was a drug crisis, or a terrorism crisis, or a street crime, or a gang crime. Even a health care crisis was an excuse to take away a little more of our rights. The old man turned to look at his grandson. They ever let you read a thing called the Constitution down there at your school? The boy solemnly shook his head. Well, the Fourth Amendment's still in there. It says there won't be any unreasonable searches and seizures. It says you're safe in your own home. The old man shrugged. That had to go. It was a crisis. They could kick your door open at any time, day or night, and come in with guns blazing if they thought you had drugs or, later, guns. Oh, at first it was just registration to keep the guns out of the hands of criminals, but that didn't work, of course. And then later they wanted to take them. They knew where to look. They banned assault rifles. And then sniper rifles and Saturday night specials, everything you saw on the TV or in the movies was against us. God knows the news people were, and the schools were teaching our kids that nobody needed guns anymore. We tried to take a stand, but we felt like the whole face of our country had changed and we were left outside. Me and a friend of mine, when we saw what was happening, we came and built a secret place up here on the mountain. Place where we could put our guns until we needed them. We figured someday Americans would remember what it was like to be free and what kind of price we had to pay for that freedom. So we hid our guns instead of losing them. One fellow I knew disagreed. He said we ought to use our guns now and stand up to the government. He said the colonists had fought for their freedom when the British tried to disarm them at Lexington and Concord. Well, he and a lot of others died in what your history books call the Tax Revolt of 2005. But, son, it wasn't the revolt that caused the repeal of the Second Amendment, like your history book says. The Second Amendment was already gone long before they ever repealed it. The rest of us thought we were doing the right thing by waiting. I hope to God we were right. You see, Thomas, it isn't government that makes a man free. In the end, governments always do just the opposite. They gobble up freedom like hungry pigs. You have to have laws to keep the worst in men under control, but at the same time, the people have to have guns, too, in order to keep the government itself under control. In our country, the people were supposed to be the final authority of the law, but that was a long time ago. Once the guns were gone, there was no reason for those who run the government to give a damn about laws and constitutional rights and such. They just did what they pleased, and anyone who spoke out, well, I'm getting ahead of myself here, took up a long time to collect all the millions of firearms that were in private hands. The government created a whole new agency to see to it. Oh, there were rewards for turning your friends in, too. Drug dealers and murderers were set free after 2 or 3 years in prison, but possession of a gun would get you mandatory life behind bars with no parole. Don't know how they found out about me. Probably knew I'd been a hunter all those years, or maybe somebody turned me in. They picked me up on suspicion and took me down to the federal building. Son, those guys did everything they could think of to me. Kept me locked up in this little room for hours. No food, no water. They kept coming in, asking me where the guns were. What guns, I said. Whenever I'd doze off, they'd come crashing in, yelling and hollering. I got to where I didn't know which end was up. I'd say I wanted my lawyer, and they'd laugh. Lawyers are for criminals, they said. You'll get a lawyer after we get the guns. What's so funny is, I know they thought they were doing the right thing. They were fighting crime. When I got home, I found Ruth sitting in the middle of the living room floor, crying her eyes out. The house was a shambles. You see, while I was down there, they'd come out, took our house apart. Didn't need a search warrant, they said. National emergency. Gun crisis. Your grandma tried to call our preacher, and they ripped the phone off the wall. Told her that they'd go easy on me if she just told them where I kept my guns. The old man laughed. She told him to go to hell. He stared into the distance for a moment as his laughter faded. They wouldn't tell her about me, where I was or anything, that whole time. She said that she'd thought I was dead. She never got over that day, your grandma, and she died the next December. They've been watching me ever since, off and on, son. I guess there's not much for them to do anymore now that all the guns are gone. Plenty of time to watch one foolish old man. He paused then. Beside him, the boy stared at the stone beneath his feet. Anyway, I figured that one day America will come to her senses. Our men will need those guns, and they'll be ready. Oh, we cleaned them, we sealed them up good. They'll last for years. Maybe it won't be in your lifetime, Thomas. Maybe one day you'll be sitting here with your son or grandson. Tell him about me, boy. Tell him about the way I said America used to be. The old man then stood, his bad leg shaken unsteadily beneath him. You see the way this stone points? You follow that line 100 feet down the hill and you'll find a big round rock. Looks like it's buried solid, but one man with a good pry bar can lift it. And there's a concrete tunnel right under there which goes back into the hill. Old man stood watching as the sun eased toward the ridge, coloring the sky in the world red. Below them, the river still splashed among the stones, as it had for 1 million years. Still going, the old man thought. There'll be someone left to carry on for me when I'm gone. That was harder to walk back. He felt old and purposeless now. And it would be easier, he knew, to give in to that aching heaviness in his left lung that had begun to trouble him more and more. Damn cigarettes, he thought. His leg hurt. The boy silently came up beside him and supported him as they started down the last mile toward the house. How quietly he walks, the old man thought. He's learned well. It was almost dark when the boy walked in. His father looked up from his paper. Did you and your granddad have a nice walk? Yes, the boy answered, opening the refrigerator. You can call Agent Goodwin tomorrow. Gramps finally showed me where it is. My friends, it's high noon.
Do not forsake me, oh my darling, on this our wedding day. Do not forsake me, oh my darling. Wait long. The noonday train will bring Frank Miller. If I'm a man, I must be brave. And I must face a man who hates me. Or lie a coward, a craven coward. Or lie a coward in my grave. Be torn twixt love and duty. Supposing I lose my fair-haired beauty. Look at that big hand move along. Yeah, and I know he made a vow while in state's prison. Vowed it would be my life or his. I'm not afraid.
Hey, honey, I'm home. I grabbed a newspaper on the way home. Look at all the news today.
Don't you know that all you're going to get in the newspaper is propaganda, twisted news, and false information?
Honey, this is a national newspaper. It has to be true.
Ha! For some reason, the majority of the population believe anything the mainstream media tells them. The newspaper doesn't give out the important attention of what's happening to this country and news that affects our daily lives. Say, does that newspaper mention anything about the North American Union?
No, not that I can see.
I didn't think so. You need to go to www.newswithviews.com, where truth is more important than political correctness. That's www.newswithviews.com. Hey, don't throw that away. We can use that in the birdcage.
Okay, move over. Let me start reading newswithviews.com.
The truth? Read all about it at newswithviews.com. Newswithviews.com, where reality shatters illusion. listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.